In Otero v. Cain, number 24-2907, counsel, take a moment to get yourselves situated, and whenever you're ready, Mr. Zerbrugge may proceed.
Before we begin with the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted. How do you pronounce your last name?
It's Zerbriggen, Judge Davis.
Second syllable. Okay. Great. Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Adam Zerbriggen from the City of Philadelphia Law Department. I represent the appellants, officers Christian Cain and Alexander Hernandez. The question of law presented by this case is the level of culpability that is required to shock the conscience for purposes of a 14th Amendment substantive due process claim, where a police officer makes the decision to pursue a fleeing suspect.
In this case, you have a Philadelphia PD directive to its officers that says that you can pursue when it's necessary to effect the arrest or escape, and it's all caps, and the officer has probable cause to believe that there has been a forcible felony, or the probable cause to believe that the person has a deadly weapon. If not, in all other circumstances, initiating a vehicular pursuit is strictly prohibited. The officers here saw no gun, and it wasn't a forcible felony. It was a person handing out what appeared to be drugs on a street corner. Why would the officers have violated that directive?
Your Honor, there's no question that all of that is correct, that the officers did violate the directive. They violated that directive in order to pursue a suspect that they observed commit a narcotics violation, or that they suspected of committing a narcotics violation. So there's no dispute in this case that they did violate that directive, and indeed they were disciplined for violating the directive. The question in this case, though, is not whether their conduct violated the directive, but whether that conduct violated the substantive due process clause of the Constitution. And there's no question that the City of Philadelphia goes beyond what the Constitution requires, and that's a good thing. Municipalities shouldn't be content with meeting the bare minimum of what the Constitution requires. They should implement best practices. And here they've done that with Directive 9.4. But the question in this case is whether they can be liable for violating the Substantive Due Process Clause simply by violating that directive and pursuing a suspect that fled. And in this case, it's first forward because it's dictated by the holding of the Supreme Court in Lewis versus County Sacramento versus Lewis, in which the Supreme Court held that in high-speed chases that are aimed at apprehending a suspect and only an intent to harm that is not justified by a legitimate object of arrest rises to the level of culpability that shocks the conscience.
Let me ask you a question about Lewis. So, as I understand what you're telling me, well, I understand what you just said, but let me ask you a question. So in Lewis, the court gave the analogy of a prison riot. Why shouldn't we understand that to mean that when courts are deciding what standard to apply, we have to consider whether and to what extent the officer was responding to an emergency?
Your Honor, for purposes of Lewis, Lewis did not require that there be an emergency. Indeed, there was no emergency at issue in Lewis. There was simply a suspect on a motorcycle that fled when the officers tried to stop that individual. Now, in Lewis,
does it matter? Was an emergency created by the 100 miles per hour flight?
It was certainly dangerous driving, Your Honor, but I don't know that it means an emergency within what this court held in Sowers. And this court was talking about either there being an emergency, so some situation in which they required a pursuit for life and death purposes, But also there's a separate statement of ours that, well, we're talking about, when we're talking about pursuits of fleeing suspects, we're within the territory of the longstanding principle in Lewis.
So just a moment ago when you talked about Lewis and you articulated Lewis, you mentioned high speed. Is it your position that all flight triggers intent to harm, or does it have to be high speed?
Yes, Your Honor, all flight triggers intent to harm, and that's what the court held squarely in Lewis. It said that
isn't there a complement to that, and that's Judge Jordan's decision in Sowers, which says that you basically look at the time to deliberate and the justification. And if the time to deliberate is hyper-pressurized, in other words, it's like, got to decide right now, then it's, you have to have, following Lewis, an intent to cause harm unrelated to the crime. Second is, there's a middle ground called hurried deliberation. You've got a little bit of time to think, and then it has to be a conscious disregard of a great risk. That's the culpability standard. And then finally, if it's unhurried, then it's just deliberate indifference. Which one is this?
Your Honor, there's no need to apply that three-part test in this case at all, because what Judge Jordan wrote in Sowers was that most high-speed cases are going to either involve emergencies or they're going to involve the flight of a fleeing suspect and a pursuit of a fleeing suspect. In those instances, we recognize, as a longstanding principle from the Supreme Court in Lewis, the intent to harm standard is going to govern. But in a different situation, in a situation that falls outside of Lewis, so like Sowers, the situation was you had an officer who noticed the suspect commit a traffic violation. The suspect was not fleeing. That officer radioed ahead, made a U-turn, and drove at a very high speed, over 100 miles per hour, just to catch up to that traffic offender who was fleeing. In that situation, what Judge Jordan recognized was that, and this court recognized, was that that situation didn't fall within Lewis. That's a different situation altogether.
Well, is it a factual determination that needs to be made as to whether something is hyper-pressurized environment versus a hurried deliberation?
No, Your Honor, because here the undisputed facts are that this is a flight of a fleeing suspect, that Mr. Ellison was fleeing. So as a matter of law...
It was fleeing. They're on Clearfield, and they're following him to the next stop sign or stop light. And only after they attempted to have him pulled over did he take off.
That's right, Your Honor.
And it was never a 100-mile-per-hour chase. It was at most 52 to 55 miles an hour. So he turns on the side street, and then he comes down East Allegheny. But the officers knew from 2008 that they were not to follow this type of person because it wasn't with a gun and it wasn't a forcible felony. So they were trained on that. So why would this be a hyper-pressurized environment?
It is an environment that is a split-second decision-making as a matter of law under the Lewis case. So to address first, Your Honor, the police directive. Absolutely. The police directive established that it was against police policy to pursue in this situation, no question. But the issue is, would an officer know that, for purposes of the qualified immunity analysis, that pursuing a fleeing suspect could lead to liability for a substantive due process violation? And the answer to that is no, because Lewis establishes that when you're pursuing a fleeing suspect, there is no liability absent intent to harm unrelated to the legitimate object of arrest.
Is it your position that Sowers is inconsistent with Lewis?
Not at all, Your Honor. Sowers says, look, Lewis dealt with a situation in which there was a fleeing suspect, a situation in which there was an emergency. Those situations are governed by that longstanding principle. But now we're confronted with a situation that doesn't fall within Lewis. It's a different situation in which, again, we have a minor traffic offender who's not even fleeing, and we have an officer who's driving recklessly to catch up. And in that situation, Lewis doesn't govern it. So we have to apply our three-part framework that Judge Ambrose was discussing with regards to other state-created danger claims.
So Sowers only applies if you don't have flight or an emergency.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Sowers makes that clear, that those situations fall within the longstanding principle of Lewis.
So if you have a minor traffic violation, and a suspect, minor traffic violation, police officers turn the light on, the suspect drives away at 15 miles below the speed limit. We're in Lewis.
Yes, Your Honor. If, I'm assuming in that situation that the officers have their lights on, it is clear that the individual is intending to flee, is fleeing. And in that situation, it falls within Lewis. The difference in Sowers was that that individual committed the traffic violation, was going down the road, certainly driving away from the officer, but there was no indication of flight.
But you don't need both. You don't need flight emergency. Either one is enough.
Either one, Your Honor. And the court made that clear in Lewis that most situations are going to involve one or the other. And when you look at cases from the, from...
Isn't it both that you have to look at the time to liberate and the justification?
I think you look at those, Your Honor, if you're outside of the territory of Lewis. So if you're not dealing with an emergency and you're not dealing with a fleeing suspect, what Sauer says is now...
But your brief doesn't argue that the district court erred while applying the three-part test we just talked about.
It erred in applying that test at all, Your Honor, and that's what we argued, is that the district court erred by not applying the straightforward holding of Lewis. Instead, what it held that
You argued that, as I recall, you argued that the court erred by applying the tripartite test, only that it shouldn't have applied the framework in the first place.
Correct, Your Honor. It shouldn't apply the framework in the first place because there's a clear holding from Lewis. And Sowers that talks about this test says, we recognize most cases are going to fall within that holding, and we don't have to measure what the justification is, what the time to deliberate was. Those cases are going to fall within Lewis, and they're going to be governed by an intent to harm standard.
Can you point me to what in Sowers, breaks up flight and split second decision separately? I'm looking at page 723, and it's talking about the intent to harm standard applies when officers make split second decisions to pursue fleeing suspects. Why should we look at that as a two-part or test instead of requiring both?
I think from directly the language that you quoted, Judge Montgomery, is that we recognize that most high-speed police pursuits arise when officers are responding to emergencies or when they make split-second decisions to pursue fleeing suspects. Our holding today does nothing to alter the longstanding principle that in such cases, in those cases, constitutional liability cannot exist absent an intent to harm.
So the boundary between Category 1 and Category 2 is a little fuzzy, because Category 2, you know, sometimes there's hours or minutes to make decisions, but then we have reference to split-second. Here, We could say they don't speed up until, you know, there's like 38 seconds of speedy chase here. We could say they had to make a split second decision about whether to speed up. But if we take it as 38 seconds, it's in between hours and minutes and split second. Which way should we define that category?
I think what Lewis holds, Your Honor, is that we don't have to make that parsing. And that's, I think it's telling that the Lewis decision and then the Davis decision that applied Lewis doesn't parse, like, you know, are we talking about 38 seconds, are we talking about a minute? It simply says that in the case of a flight from a law enforcement officer who's trying to stop, we apply an intent to harm, because those cases are, by their very nature, hurried, you know, split-second type decisions, and also that we're weighing these competing obligations, the obligation on the one hand to be safe and not endanger the public, but on the other hand to show that there's no way to freedom by flight, and that's what the Supreme Court said.
In 38 seconds, the driver of the car and his partner could have time to say, wait a minute, we got to figure out here what to do, because, you know, we got a directive that says don't pursue unless it's forcible or he has a gun, forcible felony or he has a gun. So what do we do? And they just decide to follow full speed for what that traffic allowed. So the question is, doesn't Sowers contemplate that a fleeing suspect might or might not create a dangerous situation, or does it assume that all fleeing suspects create danger?
I don't think it assumes that all suspects create a danger, but what it does assume is it assumes that what Lewis held was that an officer is not required by the Constitution anyway to make a decision to give up the chase. And that's what Lewis talked about, was officers are in being pulled by two obligations. They're being pulled by safety, and then on the other hand, to show that flight is no way free.
You're out of time, but I do want to ask you, let's assume we disagree with you about the three categories, the three categories do apply. And let's further assume that we treat this as a middle category case. Is there the recklessness, the conscious disregard of a risk here or not on the facts as the district court found them?
The district court concluded that that created a genuine issue of fact based on the directive.
What do you say? Do you agree?
We don't agree with that, that there was recklessness, but we also recognize that that the issue is limited by the appeal here being a qualified immunity appeal and being one where we have to accept the district court's conclusions about the factual record.
We could accept the factual record, but are you conceding that the facts as found amount to recklessness or conscious disregard?
I wouldn't, Your Honor. I wouldn't, and I believe we've argued that there's no indication of recklessness here. Mm-hmm. But I also think that again, our position is that is below the level of intent that's required under Lewis.
Right. Okay. Thank you. We'll have you back on rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Andra Leidacker. On behalf of the plaintiff, Joshua Otero, with me, Counsel Sable, is Mr. Charles Becker, also representing Mr. Otero. May it please the court. Your Honors, the issue before the court is whether the, under facts of this case, one, did the plaintiff state a claim for a violation of the due process clause of the 14th Amendment? And second, whether the right that we have identified under the facts of this case are clearly established that right under the both the Lewis case and also the Sowers case. I would like to pick up with something that I...
Does the fact that we're even here having this argument and your friend has authority on the other side mean that at least there's qualified immunity because it's not so clear?
I'm sorry, would you mind repeating the question?
Isn't there qualified immunity in this case? Is there clearly established law?
Yes, Your Honor. There is no qualified immunity in this case. First, Lewis established a right. It discussed the right very clearly in relation to the 14th Amendment. What the court said there is that recognized that there was a deprivation of the right to life under the circumstances described had to do with a high-speed chase. It had to do with an emergency. And then Lewis talked about an abuse of the executive power so clearly unjustified by any legitimate objective of law enforcement as to be barred by the 14th Amendment. And in addition to Lewis, we move on to Sowers, which recognized the same right as described by the U.S. Supreme Court under the facts of this case.
What about Davis? Does Davis suggest that flight alone is enough to trigger intent to harm?
In Davis, the plaintiff conceded the intent to harm was the applicable standard. What the plaintiff did in Davis was try to factually distinguish Davis from Lewis.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what do we do with the language where the court says nothing in Lewis suggests that courts are free to second guess police officers' decision to initiate pursuit of a suspect. So long as the officers were acting in the service of a legitimate governmental objective, here to apprehend one fleeing from police officers' legitimate investigation of suspicious behavior.
Your Honor, I completely agree that police officers have a lot of leeway and discretion generally. That, of course, is not the framework within which the police officers here were operating. The reason why Sowers applies here and why it's very important to actually focus on the Directive 9.4, is because the deliberation that attended, for example, in Lewis, where the policy of the city of Sacramento actually was described in Lewis, and the policy of the police department in that case was to provide a lot of discretion to the officer in when to initiate pursuit.
Has the Third Circuit ever used the violation of a police directive or regulation to help determine the level of culpability? Can you point to any case that's done that?
No, and that's not actually what we're arguing, Your Honor.
Okay, but that would seem to be relevant to qualified immunity, that you can't. Qualified immunity would say you can't use the violation of the reg to show this is clearly established.
So we're not pointing out, we're not pointing to the violation of the regulation. Mm-hmm. What we're pointing to in terms of the regulation is that the regulation already told the officers what it was to do their job under those circumstances. It took the entire deliberation back years.
That deliberation doesn't mean the fact people back at the headquarters were doing something. Deliberation is about what the officers are thinking about there.
And part of what they should have been thinking about is what the director
should have been thinking about.
Right.
Okay.
So,
these are conscious subjective standards.
They are conscious subjective standards, of course. But what we have is a police vehicle arriving at a scene where there was the call was not made with any sort of priority. Both of the officers in this case, in deposition, testified that there was no emergency.
Well, wait a second. Sorry, Lewis talks about dangerously, Sauer talks about, cites Lewis, and talks about dangerously fleeing suspects. Now you're talking about emergency. What I want to understand the term dangerously fleeing, which, you know, our case will focus on that rather than emergency. What does dangerously fleeing mean? And wasn't this suspect dangerously fleeing?
In Lewis, what the court said.
Okay, was this suspect dangerously fleeing?
Initially, when they initiated the pursuit, that suspect was not dangerously fleeing.
Okay, fine. But they're also driving at a reasonable rate of speed. They don't speed up until the suspect speeds up. So at the point where the suspect is driving almost double the posted speed limit after driving the wrong way down a one-way street and is suspected of drugs, is that dangerously fleeing?
Your Honor, yes. In terms of being on very narrow streets in Philadelphia and driving 30 miles over the speed limit, at that point, yes,
they're doing that at the point that the accident happens. So why doesn't that mean that under Sauer's own terms, he's dangerously fleeing, intent to harm applies?
Because the decision to actually follow and pursue him started much earlier. It did not start at the point where Ellison crosses the red light. The decision to pursue him started when they observed him handing out small packets of drugs in Kensington, and then they turn around and follow him. They put on their lights. They don't put on their siren. They go on for three blocks.
At a lawful, normal rate of speed, the correct way down the streets.
Right.
And you are now challenging that decision to follow at a lawful rate of speed with the lights on?
That decision is part of the time for deliberation for when these officers had to choose whether to pursue or not.
Going back to the clear, whether or not this is clearly established, are you aware of any cases within this circuit that apply anything other than the intent to harm standard when there is flight?
Sowers is...
Well, there, okay. But with Sowers, there's not flight, right? The suspect was not fleeing.
Actually, Your Honor, this actually opens up the opportunity to discuss a very important distinction that the defendants were making here. When we look at Sauer's and at Lewis, the defendants are distinguishing Sauer's from Lewis in the standard of culpability on the basis that the suspect in Sauer's did not know that they were being followed. That type of distinction does not actually speak to the officer's state of mind. And it's the officer's state of mind that is actually the culpability, that is actually what this case law is looking at. So this idea of whether the person that is being pursued understands that they're being followed, that actually doesn't fit appropriately in terms of what the court looks at when determining the culpability and whether the right was clearly established.
So you're saying there was flight in Sowers or there was not flight in Sowers?
What is important is whether the police officer was following and whether they were exhibiting the correct
amount of culpability. You say it doesn't matter, but Sowers seemed to say it mattered a lot.
It mattered a lot in terms of the decision-making of the officer. So Sowers right, the way that it is explained in Sowers, yes, so the court actually has very specific language in there about how they define the right. And they talk about the right issue here is not.
Okay, can you tell us which page you're on of Sowers so
yes,
we can follow along?
So if you have the Westlaw printout, it's on page 2 at the bottom.
No, can you tell me the page number in F3?
Number.
The citation is 717.
717, okay.
So in a Westlaw printout, it would be on the second piece of the second page. So What Sauer says is, we accordingly define the right at issue here as one not to be injured or killed as a result of a police officer's reckless pursuit of an individual suspected of a summary traffic offense when there is no pending emergency and when the suspect is not actively fleeing the police.
Okay. So okay. They define the active fleeing police as part of the right they were understanding. They did not purport to clearly establish something where a suspect is actively fleeing the police.
This is what was happening here, too. At first, he was not fleeing the police. When Mr. Ellison started off...
Okay, but can you define it as they were doing reckless pursuit before he was actively fleeing? Is it reckless pursuit to drive at a lawful speed and turn on the lights of the car? What case clearly establishes that?
Your Honor, we have a very limited number of cases on this subject, right? We have Lewis case and we have the Sowers case.
What about a consensus among the circuits? You had any other circuits, consensus among the circuits that suggests something other than intent to harm applies in the context where you have flight?
So in the context where there is a sudden flight and then the officer starts immediately to pursue on the basis of simply the flight, there is a consensus that intent to harm applies. What we have here...
Wait, I mean, you got the Eighth and the Ninth Circuits interpreting Lewis as a categorical rule, which is sounds like what you're agreeing with, but I thought that there were other circuits like the Seventh and the Tenth that took a different view. In fact, applied a deliberate indifference standard in the Tenth Circuit. So are you telling me that you now, despite that, you agree that there is... an established consensus?
No, Your Honor, I agree with you. There is the Tenth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit. They absolutely apply the entire spectrum of the shocking of the conscience within the scope of Lewis. And to the degree that we're talking about what does it mean to have a conscience-shocking standard, I fully agree that the Third Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit all apply the same framework. And I would respectfully suggest that the Eighth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit have actually gotten it wrong in terms of interpreting Lewis so narrowly that it effectively reads half of the opinion out of law. Because in Lewis, what the court talked about was that under the Due Process Clause, what you're looking at is the totality of the facts. And that is exactly what the district court looked at here. The district court didn't look at a single moment in time as the city would suggest, that you only look at the time that someone presses the gas.
You are arguing squarely that the relevant moment is when they start following him at lawful rate of speed. So that's tortious.
Your Honor, what I'm actually arguing is that the entire...
Tell me the relevant moment at which we assess the decision-making. Is it when they start following him?
No, Your Honor.
When do we gauge their mental state?
The mental state has to be gauged on the totality of the facts.
When?
In a single moment.
In other words,
what moment?
On Clearfield, when they see him or when they actually come behind him at the next stop? Going slowly, and then all of a sudden he picks up. So when is it in that time frame?
The entire time frame is within the scope of the decision making.
So it's your position that we don't look at a particular moment. We look at the entirety of the chase, no matter what it is. And how does that work?
What the U.S. Supreme Court says is that the due process violation is gauged on the totality of the circumstances. And what the police officer had to have was fair warning that what they were doing violated the Constitution.
At what moment did they have fair warning that what they were doing was violating the Constitution? By when?
When they started the pursuit, which includes the time.
As soon as they're on Clearfield, as soon as they see him, as soon as they're behind him. Do I see you nodding to that?
As soon as they see Mr. Ellison starting the engine and the police officer gets back to his car, gets in the car, makes a call to the office, right, and says, we're pursuing him.
So it is before they're speeding, yes?
Yes.
And it is before they turn their lights on?
Yes. Well,
officers, if the chase had stopped at that point, you could sue the officers and get, assuming there was some damage, right? Assuming some damages here, they don't have to speed, they don't have to turn their lights. They're still, we're still going to apply this recklessness standard. There's not, they violated a clearly established right at that point.
I wouldn't go that far because that is not within the within how both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Third Circuit would define the actual right.
Okay, by what time could they be sued? By what point here? When he puts in the call saying I'm following him, or some later point?
I was just gonna go down the points as well, but you answered the question.
How do the officers know? This is just a routine pulling somebody to a side so that. And then how the officers know that the person is fleeing at that point in time? Isn't it only when all of a sudden he takes off on Clearfield, goes down a one-way street, and then comes back on East Allegheny? Isn't that really the moment in time that you have to assess when the police officers must make a decision, pursue or not pursue?
They had direction from the police department.
Understood, but a directive and a violation of police department protocols is not ipso facto a constitutional violation. That's the point that Mr. Zabringan made. So back to Judge Bevis's question. Isn't the moment in time that they have to make a decision is all of a sudden he takes off. What do we do? They don't really think, they just follow. And doesn't that argue for whether you apply Lewis or you apply a categorical rule from Lewis as the Eighth and Ninth Circuits do, or you do something different like South does. But even in that situation, isn't it hyper-pressurized to them because they have to decide instantly? It isn't when they're coming down when they first see him, okay, here's what we're going to do. And somebody's reading the police directive and, it's like they're not even thinking about that. They come up behind him and then all of a sudden, boom, he takes off. That seems to be instantaneous.
That does, and if the facts were limited to that, yes, that is instantaneous. And that's in fact what happened.
Isn't that when the decision point starts? Back to Judge Bevis's question. That's an important question.
It is a very important question in a fact pattern like Lewis, where that's exactly when the suspect is entering the picture. And I want to reiterate that we are not arguing that it's the violation of the policy, of the department policy, that gives rise to a constitutional violation. I just want to make that very clear. What we are arguing is that the very existence of the directive is what stretches out the time. It stretches out the decisional time, because what they talked about in Lewis, the U.S. Supreme Court talked about in Lewis, is that the police officer, at the moment that the motorcycle sped past him, was torn between the idea of doing their job and following in a circumstance where a motorcycle was passing, putting others in danger.
So let me ask you, following up on Judge Bevis's question then, it sounds like you don't think the moment is the moment the, at first you said the moment is when the officer gets back to his car and they start to, and the defendant turn on his engine and they start to pursue, and then you kind of backed off that. But you also didn't seem to agree with Judge Ambrose that it's the moment that the suspect turned down the wrong street. So trying to figure out when the moment is it the moment, what moment in between those is the moment?
What I'm pushing back really on is the idea that we have to identify a moment in order to find a constitutional violation.
How are judges supposed to apply your rule? It's all telling the circumstances. You don't have to identify a moment. Just look backwards as whether someone got hurt. I'm trying to understand. Let's imagine he got permission to follow, turned on the lights, followed at a normal rate of speed, a lawful rate of speed. And the suspect gets nervous and blows through a red light and hits a pedestrian at that moment. Does your argument suggest that those officers, because they were driving lawfully but violating some police department policy, might have shocked the conscience and be liable when they never sped up or they just turned their sirens on and were trying to pull the guy over, that they could be liable for trying to do that. And then the suspect responds and blows a red light, hits a pedestrian.
Of course, that's not.
No, it's not this case. It's a hypo. I'm trying to figure out what future judges are supposed to do in a case like that.
We're trying to figure out the consequences of this decision.
And Judge Ambrose, I and Judge Bevis, I entirely understand that. It is, of course, that is a very difficult scenario, right? Because we do not have the police officers themselves speeding. But of course, it's very hard to understand what exactly at that point where whether it creates an issue of fact.
You're telling us it's clearly established, and you can't tell us what we're supposed to tell officers to do. Do you see the contradiction?
What officers are supposed to do is do their job, and their job in this circumstance was not to follow the suspect for a minor offense.
But again, we just talked, that is not necessarily a constitutional violation. That's a violation of intra police department policy. You need more, significantly more, to make a constitutional violation. That's a big thing. Yes. To say that there is a substantive due process violation. And it's not typical that we apply that highest standard.
What the Due Process Clause protects against is arbitrary action by government. And in that sense, all the facts that led into the decisions of the police officers are relevant. And we might simply ask, okay, are the actions of the police officer in Lewis, is that sort of the beginning and the end of what a reasonable police officer is supposed to do when they're doing their job? Or
just by arguing reasonable police officer, you're talking negligence.
My we're talking something. You're, right.
you're alleging something way above negligence.
Arbitrariness, yes. And in this case, against the backdrop of all the facts that there was no emergency, the call did not come in with a priority, the fact that they had ample time to think about what they were doing here, and yet they chose to initiate this pursuit. This pursuit that after three blocks, after they had time to think about it, they ended up in a high-speed chase that killed Ms. Martinez.
All right. We thank you for your argument. Let's have rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to briefly begin with the clearly established prong of the qualified immunity analysis, because I didn't get a chance to speak much about that in my opening. There's no case that the plaintiff cites here that clearly establishes, even if this court disagrees with our interpretation of Lewis.
All right. We take that. Next point. We couldn't get a time at which we could look from appellee. What will appellants tell us at the time at which we should look?
Judge Bevis, the time is the moment of decision. In the moment of decision.
The decision to start the car, the decision to call in, the decision to turn on the lights, or the decision to start driving faster or the wrong way?
The decision to speed up, because why that's important is it's the moment in which—
Exceed the speed limit, exceed normal driving.
Exceed normal driving and pursue a suspect who's, as that suspect is driving, will flee, will be out of view. And that is the moment that Lewis is concerned, because that's the moment in which the officers feel the pulls of those competing obligations that Lewis is discussing.
Are you saying flight didn't start until that moment, or did flight actually start before?
Flight in the sense that the individual is not complying with the demand to stop.
What's the, factually, how, for roughly how long the light's on before he speeds up?
It's at least several minutes, Judge Davis. Because
so there's this interesting question Judge Montgomery was alluding to, which is we normally expect someone to pull over, you know, within a minute or so as next safe possibility. So he's going on for a little while, not complying, and we should not understand that as actively fleeing?
It's not quite actively fleeing, Your Honor, because at that point in time, it's the individual is not complying, but we don't have a high-speed pursuit. We don't have a suspect who is taking off, and it's clear that he is going to attempt to try and evade the officer. So that last moment is the moment
of decision. When were the lights activated?
Lights were activated, Your Honor, just after Mr. Ellison pulls off and the officers begin the officer goes back to his vehicle, gets back in the patrol vehicle, starts to follow, puts the lights on by that first red light.
What does BWC mean? What's that word? It says in the investigation, the department investigation, police officer Kane did not activate his BWC until after the suspect's vehicle was involved in an auto accident at Allegheny Avenue and Frankfort Avenue, which occurred during the vehicle pursuit. Police officer Kane should have activated his BWC while responding to the initial radio call at Martha Street and Clearfield Street.
BWC, Your Honor, refers to the body-worn camera that the officer is wearing. So the body-worn camera was not activated. Okay. However, we do have surveillance footage. We have the testimony of the officers. The lights were activated on the patrol vehicle at that first stoplight.
I have a quick question for you. Flight. Is the question of when flight began or did not begin a fact question?
It can, Your Honor. I believe it can be. I believe there could be a dispute of material fact as to that question, but there's not here. I think everybody agrees this situation that at least by the time Mr. Ellison takes off, he is actively fleeing, and there's no contention to the contrary by the plaintiffs here. So we have an individual who is in active flight. That's why this case falls squarely within the rule of Lewis.
Isn't your best argument where you just started on your rebuttal, we look at qualified immunity, and there was no clearly established law at the time of this particular incident?
Judge Amber, I think that's right. I think that's a very simple and easy way to resolve this case, is that there's simply no case that establishes clearly and beyond debate the plaintiff's interpretation of Sowers here. But I'd also submit to Your Honors that it's a straightforward application of Lewis, and that the district courts can use the guidance, at least before the district court's decision below. No case within the Third Circuit that I'm aware of had applied less than an intent to harm standard to a fleeing suspect. And these cases, as Your Honors might imagine, come up fairly routinely. But I do think that the fact that the district court erred here in applying Sowers merits this court's decision on the first prong of the qualified immunity analysis. But I would agree with Your Honor that the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis is certainly easy and straightforward.
All right. We thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. I ask the parties to work together and prepare a transcript and split the cost.